there is freedom of speech in this country. So let people say whatever they want to say as long as there's nothing violent going on. We're here for a good cause.
Campus protesters say they have a right to speak out against the war in Gaza. But at some universities, police move in to make arrests. Campus chaos, anti-Semitic rhetoric, and expert analysis about the way forward. Opinions from this Supreme Court term could have society-changing impact. A constitutional scholar weighs in. And we travel to Istanbul, Turkey, for insight into the country's small Christian minority. EWTN News In Depth starts now. From the University of Texas in Austin to campuses around the country, anti-war protests and pro-Palestinian chants erupt, sometimes laced with anti-Semitic hate speech. University officials grapple with how to balance free speech rights versus campus chaos and lawlessness. And the New York City Police Department sweeps into the epicenter of the protest movement, Columbia University, to clear pro-Palestinian protesters out of an administration building they had broken into days before. More than 100 people were arrested Tuesday night as Columbia University invites the NYPD to remain on campus through graduation later this month. It's a volatile situation around the country. Anti-war protests disrupting university life just as schools gear up to hold graduation ceremonies. Some, like the University of Southern California, have already canceled their main graduation events out of public safety concerns. As the pro-Palestinian protests have grown, some ask whether First Amendment rights should protect anti-Semitic hate speech. Others question whether non-student outside agitators are responsible for stoking the demonstrations. Mark Irons has our report.
With the threat of being suspended from college or even arrested, students around the country have dug their stakes into the ground, camping on university property and protesting around the clock. Opposing the ongoing war in Gaza, many of these pro-Palestinian student protesters are demanding their universities cut financial ties with Israel or companies that are advancing the Israeli military effort.
Our demands are immediate divestment from corporations complicit in the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
On many college campuses across America, protests have popped up, including at the University of Texas at Austin, California Berkeley, Ohio State, Arizona State, and the University of Georgia. Many of them began after the arrest of demonstrators in mid-April at Columbia University in New York City. Since then, police have arrested more than 2,000 protesters nationwide. And back at Columbia this week, an escalation from demonstrators when they broke into and began occupying an administration building on campus. Police were sent back in to clear the building and make even more arrests. New York City Mayor Eric Adams says Columbia students were among those who broke into the building, but the effort was led by individuals who were not affiliated with the university.
There were those who were never concerned about free speech. They were concerned about chaos. It was about external actors hijacking peaceful protests and influence students to escalate. There's nothing peaceful about barricading buildings, destroying property, or dismantling security cameras.
Around the country, college officials have implored student protesters to clear out with rising levels of urgency, and some universities moved to shut down encampments after reports of anti-Semitic activity among the demonstrators. Even members of Congress have weighed in, including Speaker of the House Mike Johnson.
Because the cherished traditions of this university are being overtaken right now by radical and extreme ideologies. They place a target on the backs of Jewish students in the United States and here on this campus.
Visiting Columbia University last week, Johnson demanded an end to any anti-Semitic behavior, met with Jewish students on campus, and called for the resignation of the university president. He also spoke about actions taken on Capitol Hill in Washington.
In the House of Representatives, We've already acted to address anti-Semitism on campuses. We have passed a number of statutes to address this matter, and we call upon the U.S. Senate to act upon our legislation.
EWTN News In-Depth's Catherine Hadro visited Columbia University and spoke to students, including Catholic student Teresa Angelo, who said it's false to assume pro-Palestinian student protesters are anti-Jewish.
And I would invite people to see, like, more than only this narrative of it is one group against another.
Student Jerry Hader said the initial student protest in mid-April escalated when the university first called police onto campus. He says that attracted even more demonstrators who were not Columbia University students.
That led to escalations in rhetoric, that led to anti-Semitic chants, that led to a lot of Jewish and Israeli students feeling deeply uncomfortable.
Nick Baum, a Jewish student at Columbia University, says police and security were needed as anti-Semitic chants continued.
Especially outside the gates of campus, because it was especially outside the gates of campus where non-Columbia-affiliated protesters had amassed and shouted some horrible things. Yehudim, go away. Go back to Poland. We'll repeat October 7th 10,000 times. Those chants endanger my safety as a Jew, and we need security to be there to make sure that those active threats don't spill over into actual physical violence.
Violence has erupted at some of the protests, including this week at UCLA. Meanwhile, at Northwestern University, an agreement was reached between school officials and protesters to allow demonstrations through the end of spring classes. And at Brown University, protesters removed their encampments after the university said it would listen to student concerns and even take a vote on cutting financial ties with Israel later this year. But unrest at the University of Southern California caused officials to cancel an upcoming graduation ceremony. And in the nation's capital, we visited George Washington University, not far from the White House, where this week protesters removed barriers blocking a quad on campus.
The protest here at George Washington University has attracted not only students from this campus, but college-age students from surrounding campuses and people from the local community.
Free, free Palestine!
Rafa is a student at nearby Georgetown University. She came to add her voice to the protest as the Palestinian death toll continues to rise in Gaza.
It's literally humanity that's ending it.
According to the Gaza Health Ministry, more than 34,000 Palestinians, mostly civilians, have been killed as the Israeli military continues an offensive into the region.
I don't want any more violence. I just want peace.
Daniel, another protester at George Washington University, held a ceasefire now sign. He says he's been horrified.
Since the start of the genocide against Gaza.
But Israel rejects any accusations of genocide and says it has a right to self-defense and a right to carry out its military operation after Hamas terrorists entered Israel from Gaza on October 7th, killing some 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and taking around 250 hostages. Pope Francis has prayerfully called for peace in the Middle East. Noting the plight of the innocent suffering in Gaza, he's called for a ceasefire and the release of hostages. In the U.S., weeks' worth of tension at universities is now bumping up against the end of the semester and graduation. This student hopes peace will prevail on college campuses.
Catholics should be against using violence, especially in a college campus where you have so many young people, so many different opinions.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
President Biden broke his days-long silence on the protests on Thursday. He urged protesters to be peaceful, saying dissent is essential for democracy but must never lead to disorder. The president rejected calls from student protesters to change his approach to the war in Gaza. First Amendment scholar Professor Robert George of Princeton University has fought hard for viewpoint diversity and speech protections on campuses nationwide. Professor George, it's great to have you on with us. How do you view the protests around the country on university and college campuses right now?
Well, Monty, first, thank you for the opportunity to be on your show. It's really an honor. I'm very concerned about what I'm seeing on campuses. I believe people have a right to free speech. I've defended that right, including for people who dramatically disagree with me about the most fundamental issues. So I believe in free speech. I believe in the right of protest. But I'm very concerned about what I'm seeing because much of the protesting is shading off into anti-Semitism, the ancient, ugly, vile sin, I would call it, as the church calls it, of anti-Semitism. Jewish students on my campus here at Princeton and on other campuses such as Columbia, Harvard, University of Southern California, other places, are experiencing not only anxiety, but genuine fear. Some have been subjected to vile taunts. Their passageways into classrooms and so forth have been blocked. This is not free speech. This is an attack on the fundamental and basic rights and dignity of our Jewish brothers and sisters. And we must not tolerate it. And we Catholics need to be in the forefront of denouncing anti-Semitism in all forms. Now, that doesn't mean that we're not allowed to criticize Israel. Israel is a state. It's got a government like any other state and government, including our own. We freely criticize our government. Israeli Jews themselves criticize their government. So this is not about the immunity of the Israeli government from criticism. But criticism of a government or its policies is one thing. Calling for the elimination of a people, engaging in bigotry, that's another thing altogether. Now, we have to, as a matter of free speech, we have to tolerate even bad speech, even anti-Semitic speech, even what's sometimes called hate speech. There's no hate speech exception to the First Amendment. But while we have to tolerate it, we can call it out for what it is, and we can stand up against it, and we can show solidarity for our Jewish brothers and sisters, the people that Pope St. John Paul the Great, as I call him, Pope St. John Paul II, called our brothers and indeed our elder brothers in faith.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. In the wake of the October 7th attacks, you spoke at Steubenville University and urged that Christians must do more than merely reject anti-Semitism, quoting St. Pope John Paul II, or the Great, who established diplomatic relations with Israel. That's relatively new. He said, "It must be understood that the Jews, who 2,000 years ago were dispersed among the nations of the world, decided to return to the land of their ancestors. This is their right, recognized from the outset by the Holy See, and the act of establishing diplomatic relations is simply an international affirmation of that relationship." That's what he quoted. How should Catholics then manifest that relationship today? It's complicated.
Well, we have to recognize the right of our Jewish friends to practice their religion. We have to stand up for the right of the Jewish people in Israel, the state of Israel, to defend its borders as we would defend ours, to defend its people as we would defend ours and have defended ours. Again, that doesn't mean that Israel should be exempt or immune from criticism. Criticism is legitimate, too. But we should not stand by idly while people call for the destruction of Israel or the elimination of the Jews, quote, from the river to the sea. We need to raise our voices in opposition to any such genocidal rhetoric.
And when you think about the defense of religious freedom for all that you have waged, the freedom of all people, is terrorism not, it's not a protected religion or a group? How do
we think about
freedom of speech then, especially in light of violence?
Let me add one more thing to what I've said before. We should feel the same sympathy we feel for Jewish victims of terrorism, for innocent Palestinians who have suffered and are suffering mainly as a result of the Hamas terrorism attacks on Israel on October 7th. Now, there's a long history. There are disputes. There are rights and wrongs between Israelis and Palestinians. And we all hope and pray for the day when those disputes can be justly and reasonably and peacefully settled, and people can live alongside each other despite their ethnic and religious differences in peace and harmony. We look forward to that. We need to work for that. But again, we must not tolerate violence or the calls for violence against innocent people. Now, Monsi, in our constitutional law and in the rules of my own university, it's a private university, but we've adopted basically the free speech principles of American constitutional law here at Princeton. We place no restrictions at all, and I support this. We place no restrictions at all on the content of speech. So we feel we have to put up with even the vilest sorts of speech. But we do place reasonable regulations, which we enforce in a viewpoint neutral way, on the time, place, and manner of speech. Now, that means that we distinguish free speech from all sorts of things that aren't free speech. Violence, intimidation, actual threats, incitement to imminent violence, vandalism, disruption of classes or other university activities, attacks on people at their homes, those kinds of things. And those restrictions matter too because they protect basic rights of people. Free speech is an important right, and as you rightly noted, I've spent an enormous amount of my career and my attention defending the right to free speech. But it's not the only right. The right to peacefully conduct your class, the right to peacefully learn, the right to peacefully inhabit and enjoy your home. These are rights too, and those rights have to be protected. So my position is no viewpoint-based restrictions on speech, but we need to firmly enforce reasonable time, place, and manner regulations in a viewpoint-neutral manner.
Well, that's really important. Talking about your university particularly and the access that you have to this new generation of students, are you seeing a difference in how they take on protests, how they feel about anti-Semitism?
Well, one of the worrying things is that anti-Semitism has become acceptable in some circles of American society. Now, we never actually finally destroyed that monster. There's always been an element of anti-Semitism in life, including in American life, but we had reduced it to what seemed to be a fringe phenomenon on the extreme right or the extreme left. It's coming back in a kind of mainstream way, and that really, really worries me. And I know it worries our Jewish friends and fellow citizens. They've seen this movie before, Monsi. They know how it begins. And it begins with the toleration of this anti-Semitism, with people not speaking out against it, but people being discriminated against, attacked, simply because they're Jewish. This is just unacceptable. The church teaches us it's unacceptable. The greatest stain on the conscience of the church are the many, many decades and even centuries in which the church itself was involved in anti-Jewish activities, or at least anti-Jewish sentiments. And the church, in its great document, Nostra Aetate, of the Second Vatican Council, repudiates that altogether. It says that any discrimination or hostility or animosity toward Jews by anybody, at any place, at any time, is unacceptable and indeed sinful. We as good and faithful Catholics have to take that on board and take that seriously. And that means more than that we ourselves refrain from being anti-Semites or being anti-Jewish. It means that we have to stand in solidarity with the Jewish community and with anybody, including Palestinians, who are suffering or who are subjected to injustice.
Well, that's certainly a call to action and a reminder of the important tenets of our faith. Professor George, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
It's so good to be with you, Monsi. Thank you.
Meantime, as campus protests over the war in Gaza continue, ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas appear to be gaining steam. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken continued his shuttle diplomacy to broker the talks. In his seventh trip to the Middle East since the Israel-Hamas war started in October, Blinken met with King Abdullah in Jordan, Arab foreign ministers in Riyadh, and then on to Israel for talks with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. With all parties, Blinken stressed the need to free the remaining hostages and to increase the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. There's much more coming up. A consequential term at the U.S. Supreme Court. Arizona backs down on pro-life legislation as Florida goes all in. And we go on the road to Istanbul to learn about Christian life in Turkey. EWTN News In Depth will be right back. The waiting game begins as the U.S. Supreme Court deliberates the dozens of cases it heard this term. The High Court wrapped up oral arguments less than 2 weeks ago, and rulings are not far behind. In the next 2 months, the Supreme Court will release case decisions before it reaches summer recess at the end of June. These decisions take on numerous hot-button issues and will impact the law of the land for decades to come.
There's going to be plenty of trips that monitor will make more than myself or my crew.
The power of federal agencies is at the center of the Supreme Court case Loper Bright Enterprises versus Raimondo. Commercial fishermen brought this case to the Supreme Court after the National Marine Fisheries Service required them to carry and pay for an observer on their boats to monitor their work. The case concerns Chevron deference, a decades-old legal decision that allows federal agencies to interpret laws passed by Congress when the text is silent or ambiguous. Chevron has been cited almost 20,000 times in court proceedings across America, and changing it could impact regulations coming out of all federal agencies, from finance to healthcare.
Whose court?
And for the first time since overturning Roe v. Wade almost 2 years ago, the Supreme Court takes on abortion. In two cases, the justices will consider the safety of the abortion pill, mifepristone, and determine whether emergency room doctors in Idaho are required to provide abortions under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, or EMTALA. Among the court's other high-profile cases are three on gun laws. United States versus Rahimi deals with a federal law that prohibits people who are subject to domestic violence restraining orders from owning a firearm. Garland versus Cargill concerns a federal mandate outlawing bump stocks, a device attached to semi-automatics that enables faster firing. And in the National Rifle Association versus Vullo, the NRA claims that a New York official violated the group's rights when she encouraged banks and insurance companies to cut ties with the gun advocacy group.
I said housing, you said no, housing,
no.
Housing,
no.
In City of Grants Pass versus Johnson, the Supreme Court will decide whether an Oregon law criminalizing public encampments is cruel and unusual punishment against homeless people who have nowhere else to go. The court seemed divided over ideological lines in a case that could impact laws in other states like Texas, Kentucky, and Florida. Another group of major cases concerns the new public square. Murphy versus Missouri examines the federal government's ability to communicate with social media companies about their content moderation. The case stems from the Biden administration's efforts in 2021 to encourage social media sites to restrict misinformation on the COVID-19 vaccine, which challengers allege violated their rights to free speech. Two other cases center around laws in Texas and Florida that regulate how social media companies control content posted on their sites. NetChoice, the plaintiff in both cases, believes the laws violate social media companies' ability to manage the content that appears on their platforms. The Supreme Court will release rulings until the end of June or into early July.
To discuss this term and these important cases, we're joined by attorney Adam White, a constitutional scholar and senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Adam, it's great to have you back. This was certainly a big term, one with a lot of hot button issues. They have not shied away from these difficult topics. First, let's get into the Trump election case that was just argued. What is at stake for presidential power?
Well, President Trump has found himself in court in a few different places, but including the Supreme Court. The court's already pushed back against an effort to remove him from electoral ballots in the upcoming presidential election. And now President Trump faces questions over whether he had immunity for the actions he took leading up to January 6th. The court seemed skeptical of the sweeping claims of complete immunity that President Trump's lawyers had advanced. But there were real questions among the justices about how to define the scope of presidential immunity and what kind of factual proof a president might need, or former president might need, to prove that he had immunity over actions. My guess is the court's going to issue a mixed ruling on that issue and send it back to the trial courts for further development.
Do you think that we could see the kind of push to limit the power of the Supreme Court now coming from the right rather than the left, the way that we saw earlier in the election season?
Well, I don't see a burgeoning call to pack the court as we saw a few years ago. And I served on President Biden's commission to study the Supreme Court in the aftermath of those arguments for court packing. So I'm always wondering where that might bubble up, whether at the federal level or the state level, but mercifully, we've not seen a whole lot of that lately.
That's very good. I agree with you. That's mercy. The Chevron case, then. Let's talk about federal regulations or the case about the fishermen who were forced to have this government monitor on their boat. That's the one that everyone's holding their breath for. Agencies have leveraged their power to force nuns to pay for abortion and contraceptives in their health care plans. You also have the Biden transgender ruling that forces doctors to provide these procedures and hospitals to cover them. Could you see these regulations and these agencies curbed by this case?
Well, the way you frame that, I think, is absolutely right to give a sense of the scope of this. So many of the cases the Supreme Court and the lower courts are hearing now, while we think of them as involving maybe constitutional rights, whether the right to free speech, the Second Amendment, and so on, they're filtered through administrative agencies, and they become questions about the agency's powers under the statutes that Congress has written. But of course, Congress often writes those statutes in very vague or very broad language. And so this case about what you called Chevron deference, this doctrine that the courts will often defer to an agency's interpretation of the law, becomes incredibly important across all areas of law. It's a question about who really is interpreting the statutes. And here, I think the Supreme Court left some real questions after oral argument about what they'll ultimately decide. I don't anticipate a sweeping decision one way or the other, but certainly a recalibration of how much deference agencies are getting, which hopefully will change not just the way the courts go about their work, but also the agencies and maybe also Congress in writing those laws in the first place. It could have a huge effect across areas of law.
One of the questions that came up in oral argument was about the divided Congress. Do you think that the Supreme Court will be taking that into account, their inability to pass laws?
That always hovers in the background of cases involving what Congress has done and what it might do next. But I often think that looking at the gridlocked Congress right now as justifying greater deference to agencies gets things precisely backwards. I think one of the reasons, maybe even a major reason, why Congress has become so gridlocked and so inert over the years is the fact that agencies, not Congress, have become the driving force of our politics and our policymaking. The courts have accommodated that largely through the doctrines like Chevron deference. They've taken away a lot of the impetus for Congress to actually act. And so one of the things I'm hopeful for is that if the Supreme Court does tell the lower courts to be less deferential to agencies, that might channel political energy back to Congress. If you want to change a law, don't go to the EPA, don't go to the Department of Treasury, go back to Congress and have them rewrite the law in the first place.
It's going to make for a very interesting election season. Well, let's get into gun cases. Gun cases that impact the pro-life movement, but not in the way that some people might think. If you think about NRA versus Vullo, which would address whether the government is allowed to pressuring companies not to do business with groups or with organizations that it disagrees with. Could this NRA versus Vullo case lead to a state being able to discourage doing businesses with companies that the government doesn't like? So cutting ties with pro-life businesses or with those who support traditional marriage?
Whatever one thinks of gun rights, the Second Amendment, gun control, it is ominous that government officials would try to jawbone banks and others into not doing business with something like the NRA. It's one thing for companies or individuals to voluntarily choose not to give business to an institution. But for government officials to put pressure on others, that's ominous. I think that's one of the reasons why, in this case, if I recall correctly, the NRA was represented by an ACLU lawyer, which is not something you hear every day. But we're seeing more and more of this. Another example, a couple of cases you mentioned where the Biden administration was pressuring social media companies to take down content that the Biden administration didn't like. Whether it's pressuring the social media platforms, pressuring financial institutions, we're seeing more and more of this kind of passive-aggressive regulatory activity where government is trying to jawbone other institutions, private institutions, into penalizing disfavored institutions and individuals. So I'm watching both the NRA case and also the social media case.
Well, they're important cases to watch also because although the Supreme Court did move on pornography and free speech on pornography, and we'll see something there, the one thing that is looming over them is transgender rights. You know well that sometimes the cases that aren't taken are the most significant. The Indiana parents who had their child removed by family services because they wouldn't use the child's preferred pronouns, talk about ominous. Could the Supreme Court, because it didn't take up that case, take up a case in the future about Kentucky and Tennessee and their bans on transgender procedures for minors?
The court often just declines to take a case for any number of reasons. It might be because the issue at hand is too fact sensitive or other procedural reasons. It's hard to read too much into the court not taking a case. But even when the court doesn't take up a case, that might help to put an issue on the radar of the justices for future cases. So as you're seeing more and more questions about the collision of the transgender rights movement and religious liberty, free speech, parental rights, and on, we're going to see more and more of these cases coming up to the court. The Supreme Court, I think, still has pending a couple of other cases raising some issues about transgender rights and parents' rights. And it'll be interesting to see when the court finally takes up a case.
Absolutely. The scope of parental rights is something we're all looking out for. Well, thank you so much, Adam. Always appreciate your expertise.
Thank you.
News headlines are next in the Week in Review. The overturning of Arizona's 160-year-old abortion law tops the Week in Review. The law protected life from the moment of conception and received national condemnation because, in part, it became law before women had the right to vote.
There you go. Hey.
Governor Katie Hobbs signed the repeal on Thursday. The Civil War era law briefly went into effect after the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 2022, but was immediately blocked by a lower court. Then, in April of this year, the Arizona Supreme Court revived the law. Democratic Arizona lawmakers immediately moved to repeal the law, but were just shy of the necessary votes in the Republican-controlled legislature. After 3 weeks of voting, the repeal finally earned enough votes in both the House and Senate when a few pro-life Republicans sided with Democrats. Though signed into law, the repeal will not go into effect until 90 days after the state legislature adjourns, meaning the 1864 law could still take effect for a short time this summer. One abortion law reversed, another enforced. Florida's heartbeat abortion limit took effect this week. The legislation protects life after 6 weeks of gestation, or around the time a fetal heartbeat can be detected. The law faced a long legal battle at the state Supreme Court, but now replaces a previous 15-week ban. Florida had some of the loosest restrictions on abortion in the southern United States, making it a destination for women seeking the procedure. Governor Ron DeSantis celebrated the law, but some expressed concern the law could lead to a mass exodus of OBGYNs in the state.
Being able to provide protections for a baby that has a detectable heartbeat is lawful and constitutional.
I know that there are definitely OBGYNs who are moving out of state. We're going to have less access to care for our general population, even if it's just basic maternity care or normal OBGYN care, because people are leaving.
The law could still die in November when Florida voters decide whether to insert what's called a right to abortion in the state constitution. A federal appeals court in Virginia ruled this week that transgender procedures must be covered by state insurance. The ruling concerns North Carolina and West Virginia, which banned coverage of certain gender transition treatments. West Virginia Attorney General Patrick Morrissey decried the ruling and said he'll take the case up to the U.S. Supreme Court. World Central Kitchen has resumed humanitarian aid operations in Gaza a month after seven of its workers were killed in an attack by the Israel Defense Forces. Israeli Defense Forces faced international condemnation after the strike accidentally hit a World Central Kitchen convoy delivering food to people in Gaza. The pause in service heightened a humanitarian crisis in Gaza, where hundreds of thousands of people do not have adequate food or water. The humanitarian organization says it served 200,000 meals on Tuesday, and almost 300 trucks were ready to enter Gaza with enough food for 8 million meals. World Central Kitchen founder Jose Andres said it's not easy to return to humanitarian efforts after the tragic incident, but it's necessary. In an editorial this week, Andres wrote, "We cannot stand by while so many people are so desperate for the essentials of life. Food is a universal human right, and we will not cease until basic human rights are respected." The United States Commission on International Religious Freedom, or USERF, released its annual report this week. The document details the state of religious liberty around the world and recommends the U.S. State Department which nations should be designated as countries of particular concern for egregious violations. In the 17 nations designated as countries of particular concern, shown in red, the government engages in or tolerates particularly severe violations of religious freedom. These nations include China, Russia, Nicaragua, and, for the first time, Azerbaijan. The 11 nations shown in orange are designated as special watch list countries, where the government engages in or tolerates severe violations of religious freedom. This is the first year the Central Asian nation of Kyrgyzstan made that list. This report marks the 25th anniversary of the International Religious Freedom Act, the federal law that made religious freedom a higher priority in U.S. foreign policy. Aram Hamparian of the Armenian National Committee of America explained to EWTN News Nightly's Tracy Sable the significance of this law.
It was a bold report on its 25th anniversary now. Chairman Frank Wolf. Was the author of the bill 25 years ago. Ever since then, it's really been a powerful tool for U.S. policymakers. Prior to this law, there was this idea that you could either care about national security or care about religious liberty. The fact is that one and the both of them are really the same. It's from one cloth. Religious liberty around the world really contributes to American security.
Using USERF's recommendations as a guide, the State Department will release its official designations at the end of this year. 300 priests from around the globe joined 4 days of important meetings in Italy this week during the Synod on Synodality's World Meeting of Parish Priests. The goal of the meetings was to listen to clergy on the front lines of evangelization. Their insights could inform the second and final synodal assembly at the Vatican this October. Just 5 parish priests from the United States were invited to attend. We are honored to be joined by one of them. Father Donald Planty Jr. is a pastor at St. Charles Borromeo Catholic Church in the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia. He joins us from the EWTN Vatican Bureau. It's great to have you with us, Father Planty. Participants at the first session of the Synod on Synodality last year suggested that listening more to the voices of parish priests who minister to everyday Catholics face-to-face was important. And so, heeding that advice, the Vatican gathered 300 of you from around the world. What can you share about this experience?
As you can imagine, it was great to be with 300 brother priests from every corner of the world gathering together in Rome, in a retreat center outside of Rome, to discuss the ways that we can support the Church's synodal path. That is, the way that we can all work together with the faithful in our parishes, accompanying one another, walking with one another. Synodal means on the same way, on the same path. And we do so by all working together with co-responsibility for the mission of the Church. Each one of us, a missionary disciple, each according to their own gifts and their own vocation. And of course, the meeting concluded with an audience with the Holy Father yesterday, at which we exchanged conversation and questions with the Holy Father. And then each one of us was able to meet the Holy Father afterwards.
And what was that like? Your background is obviously unique. You've worked on university campuses and served in many countries, and you're fluent in several languages. Did you share anything with the Holy Father that spoke to whether this gathering was representative of the global church?
I did not submit a question to be asked of the Holy Father, but a number of priests from around the world did, and it was a great, beautiful, and fraternal exchange between all of us.
And then how do you think this gathering will influence the upcoming reports and then that final synod gathering in October that we're all anticipating?
So the 300 priests were gathered into working groups. We had many conversations about fundamental themes involving synodality, how we all collaborate in the same mission in the Church. And all of our feedback and all of our discussions have been summarized in different group reports. And those summaries will be used to inform the Instrumentum Laboris, that is the working document that will serve for contemplation and discussion at the second session of the Synod in October.
And did you find that your experiences that you shared were significantly different from your brother priests, the other 300 that were there?
What I found was we all share the same experiences on one level, but we also all share very different experiences on another level. Inasmuch as we're all parish priests in the trenches, ministering to the faithful through the prophetic mission of proclaiming and teaching the faith, through the priestly mission of offering people the sacraments, celebrating the sacraments with them, through the shepherding mission of gathering people together in charity and ministering to various needs, we all share in that same priestly ministry, and that really united us beautifully as we recognize that we all share in that same mission. At the same time, coming from so many different countries and so many different cultures, we realized there were many differences in the way that mission is lived out. It's going to be lived out differently in Arlington, Virginia, across the river from our nation's capital in the United States, as it is in Portugal or in East Timor or in Syria, for example.
Well, one last thing. You obviously were very involved in the Arlington Diocese, working on the preparations for the Synod and submitting your recommendations after having listening sessions. How is this experience that you just had in Rome going to affect what you bring back to your home diocese?
I'll be happy to share some of the conversations we had with our brother priests back in the diocese. But I would say that our diocese, like I think many dioceses in the United States, already live synodality in a very robust way. We are used to, in our Anglo-Saxon democratic culture, of people manifesting their opinions to their sacred pastors, which is not only their right, but their obligation according to church law. But we all work together, whether it's paid staff, volunteers, ordinary parishioners. We are always working together to advance the mission of the church, to understand that we're all called to be missionary disciples. So I think there are many stories I can share with my brother priests and with our bishop and with our people back in the Diocese of Arlington about the way synodality and the mission is lived differently in different countries. But I do think that we in the Arlington Diocese, like so many in the United States, already do collaborate so much for the apostolate and for the mission.
Well, we're praying for your safe return home and are grateful that you took the time to be here with us. Thank you so much, Father Planty.
My family is Muslim, and they're like Muslim, let me say. And they accepted me.
Next, the extraordinary determination of a very small Christian minority in Turkey. We travel to this predominantly Islamic country to learn about how an even smaller Catholic community is able to survive. We'll be right back.
It was one of the largest earthquakes ever recorded in the Middle East. A magnitude 7.8 quake striking central Turkey and Syria in February of 2023, causing widespread destruction and thousands of deaths. Aftershocks continued to rock the area for months. A year after that earthquake, EWTN News In Depth traveled back to Turkey to check on recovery efforts. And we met with leaders of the very small Catholic community there to talk about Christian religious life in a Muslim country. Correspondent Colin Flynn arrived at a tense moment.
Now to Istanbul, where one person's been killed and several injured.
On the 28th of January 2024, gunmen burst into Santa Maria Catholic Church in the Turkish city of Istanbul and opened fire, killing one person. At the very same time, we were in another church 20 minutes away, filming the Bishop of Istanbul celebrating Mass.
Just during the celebration of the Holy Mass, one faithful in our parish was killed during the consecration. Let us pray. Unfortunately, the daily life of Christians is very difficult, and in some places it could be even dangerous. Turkish people say, Allah korusun, may the Lord keep us from bad people.
Police say it was not a religious attack, but rather a targeted killing of a certain individual. But then the terrorist organization ISIS claimed responsibility, so it's hard to know the truth of what exactly happened.
The history of Christianity is deeply rooted here in Turkey, going back centuries. I'm standing in what was once the great Christian city of Constantinople, now Istanbul. And today, Christians make up just 0.2% of the entire population. So who are these people, and what are the challenges they face, and what is the role of Christianity in Turkey today? Christianity began to spread quickly in this land during the era of the Roman Empire, finding a foothold in cities like Antioch and Ephesus, which are now part of modern-day Turkey. And in the west of the country is a site that many Christians consider to be holy.
We are in the house of Mary. This is the house of Mary. We call in Turkish Meryemana Evi.
The House of Mary is located near the city of Ephesus and is believed to be the place where the Virgin Mary spent her final years, according to Catholic tradition. Father Javahad Jerry Kitano is a friar living in the monastery at the shrine and explains that it is believed Mary came here with the Apostle John after Jesus had risen from the dead.
It was the God's will that she had to come here, because the ancient Turkey, geographical Turkey, is the cradle of Christianity, I could say. Because St. John's community was here, St. Paul also was here for 3 years, St. Paul's community also was here. So which means this place, this land is a holy land.
Inside the House of Mary, a private mass is being celebrated by Father Martin Kimek, the Bishop of Izmir. He's originally from Slovenia, but has been in Turkey for 22 years.
Truly right and just, our duty and our salvation, always.
And after Mass, he tells me he's under no illusions as to the challenges the Church faces today.
What is it like serving as an Archbishop here in Izmir, in Turkey?
A lot of work, a lot of service. Continual prayer, because I feel that many times without the help of our Lord, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Why do you say that?
Because it's not easy. It's, the situation here is, I think for every bishop is the same. We are a very small community, and we are striving not only to survive, but to have our place here as a light of the world, if I can say like that.
Striving to survive. With the rise of Islam in Turkey over the centuries, the Christian faith saw not only a natural decline, but a forced decline too. I travelled back to Istanbul from Izmir, where, close to the famous Grand Bazaar, I met a young missionary priest from Austria, Father Sivo Herman, who told me that the church here is free to spread the gospel, but in reality, they know the limits.
We respect certain limits. Then, for example, I don't have any promise to preach here in the church what I want. The doors are open, everybody might enter who wants. But if I go outside on the street with a megaphone and start to preach, then I can be sure that in a short time they will arrive, the police saying, no, that's not possible.
But even with those limits, he sees a beauty and opportunity in having such a small church here.
The beauty is that here as a church we are really living in that sense, the word that Jesus said in the Gospel, that we are called to be light, to be salt for the world.
Breaking news, an earthquake on a terrifying scale.
In southern Turkey.
Turkey hit international headlines in 2023 when a massive 7.8 magnitude earthquake struck the south of the country, along the border with Syria. Towns and villages were destroyed, and more than 50,000 people died. Churches were badly damaged too, like the Church of the Annunciation in Iskenderun. Father Antoine Iliget is the parish priest.
Was there still rubble falling? Was the ground still shaking? What was it like when you entered the church in that very moment?
No,
everything was gone. It was like this.
I climbed up on the rubble and looked out over my city.
With their church destroyed, Father now celebrates Mass in a small hall in the parish center. And today, around a year after the earthquake, they are having a retreat for young people. And while older generations who have converted from Islam to Christianity might be more reluctant to talk about it, it seems these young people are not.
I just had an urge to research about Christianity, and then I became Christian.
Wow. Yeah. So this wasn't something that your family was doing, or you just decided by yourself?
Yeah, I just decided by myself. My family is Muslim, and they're Muslim, let me say. And they accepted me, by the way. When I started the research about Christianity, the first thing I felt was God's with me. I felt him, and I can't explain it.
The Catholic is a bit more for younger people, to be honest. I think it's pretty special to be a Christian in Turkey because it's 0.2 of the population. It's pretty low, and people get interested when they heard, oh, she's a Christian? Oh, I gotta ask her some questions.
Being a Christian in Turkey may be one thing, but publicly declaring it with zeal and enthusiasm is another. There have been cases of Christian missionaries being deported from the country for trying to spread the gospel on the street. One of those people is David Beale. He is originally from Canada, but lived in Turkey for 19 years, where four of his five children were born.
I was a volunteer with a Christian organization that was serving churches throughout Turkey, especially in following up people who had expressed interest in the Bible. So.
And David, it's incredible to think that as I stand here now in what was once your home for so many years, you're now banned from entering this country. What happened?
5 years ago, when I flew into Istanbul, the police stopped me and they said, you have a permanent entry ban. In the court documents, the way they worded it, they said that my Christian propaganda activities exceeded usual religious rituals, and therefore members of other religions saw me as a threat, and therefore the government could also see me as a threat to national security and kick me out.
The sense I got from the religious that I met here during my week in Turkey was that it can be hard to stay encouraged. And even though, yes, there are those who are interested in learning about the Christian faith, those numbers are small and not getting any bigger.
What are the signs of hope that you see when you look at Christianity across this country?
Yes, sign of hope. The first, the communion of love of all Christians here, living here in Turkey. In many other countries, the different Christian denominations are still fighting against each other. Here, we feel the necessity to overcome our diversities and live together and work together following Jesus faithfully.
You said that you're in your Mass today. From small things, yes, great things can come.
Yes, yes. I hope so. I hope. But we should not measure these things with our human measures. Jesus did not say, I will submit the world to you. He said, I will remain with you until the end.
In Turkey, Colm Flynn, EWTN News in Depth.
An important message from our brothers and sisters in Turkey who need our prayers. When we come back, we'll introduce you to some young Catholics about to step off on the National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. Are you ready to grow closer to our Lord Jesus Christ in the Eucharist? We're just weeks away from what promises to be one of the most exciting events in the American Catholic Church in years. The National Eucharistic Revival, which invites us to return to the source and summit of the Christian life, is ongoing for 3 years. And this July, it reaches a high point in Indianapolis with the first National Eucharistic Congress in the United States in 83 years. This pivotal moment in the Catholic Church will kick off in just 2 weeks with the start of a 2-month National Eucharistic Pilgrimage. From four corners of the United States, participants will walk with the Holy Eucharist on one of four routes dedicated to a special saint. Past missions, cathedrals, shrines, and other important Catholic landmarks, in prayer and adoration, pilgrims will end their journey at the Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. EWTN News will be traveling along those routes to bring you special coverage of this faith journey. A small group of young Catholics has been selected by the National Eucharistic Congress to go the entire length of their routes. They're called Perpetual Pilgrims. Our correspondents have been talking to some of these pilgrims about their upcoming religious experience.
I thought that it's going to be a way that I can become more like Jesus. And so I hope that in the next, 2 months on our pilgrimage, I hope that by the end of it, I am more like him.
I really hope that this pilgrimage can bring all of us together, despite all of the polarization that exists in this country and in the West overall.
Come follow him. Jesus is coming to our country and he wants to meet his people. He wants to bring everyone to himself. And so there are many ways to participate in the pilgrimage, even if it's just kind of watching as it goes by. I feel very chosen by the Lord to be on this. And I don't deserve it, but he has called. He wants me to go. If one person, their infinite heart and their infinite soul was saved because of this, it's worth it.
As we said, these perpetual pilgrims will all end up at the National Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis in July, and you can be there too. Sign up at EWTN.com/Eucharist and click on Register Now to receive a discount. And join EWTN for our special breakout session, Transforming the World, Eucharist and Evangelization, on Thursday afternoon, July 18th. And that's a wrap on this edition of EWTN News In Depth. I'm Montse Alvarado. Next week at this time, we will air an EWTN News In Depth special report on the National Eucharistic Revival, the pilgrimage that kicks off in 2 weeks, and the Eucharistic Congress in Indianapolis. We hope you'll join us to learn more and consider your own participation in this journey of faith. See you then.